Up next on WHPC is Alt U, hosted by
everybody, and welcome to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio, which means it's time for How Music Changed, something that Heidi and I bring to you every Friday between 5 and 6 p.m. I'm Tom Ryan, my lovely wife Heidi Morales Ryan with me as well.
We made it.
We did. Through 6 inches of rain.
Probably.
An incredible amount of rain for us to be here. Happy to, of course, as you know, on the How Music Changed series, as we arrange information about what we consider to be 250 of the most important artists and or events in the history of recorded music. We have been focusing recently on the Beatles. This is show number 38 in our chronological look at a history of the Beatles, and it brings us to a very interesting time in their career, which is to say the early part of 1967, as the Beatles are undergoing a fundamental change in so many ways. Of course, the first thing, the main thing that's happening is they have decided they are not recording, they will not be performing live any longer. And this has given them, freed them up to have a lot of time. And they've also decided that they are not going to worry about how much time they spend in the recording studio either. And it makes a huge difference. Where in the past, they would previously start and finish a recording, usually in the same day. They were now willing to take weeks. There was nothing that was going to hold them back from this unalloyed creativity that they had now. There was no clock to punch, nobody holding their feet to the fire, so to speak, to insist that they meet deadlines. So they were just going to take their time and see how songs progressed and developed. The first result, as we discussed last week, the entire show was dedicated to the first single, which was the result of all of their efforts. And that was the single, of course, of Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane.
Right.
And there's a couple of quotes that I didn't cover. I wanted to actually cover Paul's take on Penny Lane as the single was finished. Here's Paul McCartney speaking now. Penny Lane was a little more surreal, too, although in a cleaner way, comparing it to John's song. I remember saying to George Martin, I want a very clean recording. I was into clean sounds, maybe a Beach Boy influence at that point. The fireman with his hourglass and all that imagery was us trying to get into a bit of art. The lyrics were all based on real things. There was a barber called something like Bialetti. I think he's actually still there in Penny Lane. Who, like all barbers, had pictures of the haircuts you could choose. But instead of saying the barber with pictures of haircuts in his windows, it was changed around to every head he's had the pleasure to have known. A barber showing photographs, like an exhibition.
Right. It's a little more artistic sounding that way.
Yeah, exactly. Continue with Paul. It was twisting it to a slightly more artsy angle. There you go.
Hey, there you go.
More like a play.
I'm inside his head.
Right. Like the nurse who's selling poppies from a tray, which some Americans thought was selling puppies from a tray. For Remembrance Day. Then she feels as if she's in a play, which she is anyway. These were all the trippy little ideas that we were trying to get in. They're both songs about Liverpool as well, meaning John's song as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was always a good thing for us because we were a group that had been together for a long time, that we could do that. Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, wow. A lot of our formative years were spent talking around those places. Penny Lane was the depot I had to change buses at to get from my house to John's and to a lot of my friends. It was a big bus terminal, which we all knew very well. I sang in the choir at St. Barnabas Church opposite. Those two songs were the lead singles. They were the first thing we tried in the batch of new recordings. Again, Paul. It's part fact, part nostalgia for a great place, blue suburban skies as we remember it, and it's still there. And we put in a joke or two. Four of Fish and Finger Pie. The women would never dare say that except to themselves. Most people wouldn't hear it. But finger pie is just a nice little joke for the Liverpool lads who liked a bit of smut.
Oh, God.
And this is a line that went right past critics and Americans because, you know, what? Obviously an English expression for basically, I guess you could say, like, we have, like, bases first base, second base, you know, get third base, perhaps, from an American standpoint. George Martin's take, though, on the result of the single after it was released is a bit fairly realistic. Here's him being the producer, of course. Here's his quote. "The only reason that Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane didn't go on to the new album was a feeling that if we issued a single, it shouldn't go on to an album. And that was a crazy idea, and I'm afraid I was partly responsible. It's nonsense these days, but in those days, it was an aspect that we'd tried to give the public value for money."
Hmm.
"The idea of a double A-side came from me and Brian, really. Brian was desperate to recover popularity, and so he wanted to make sure that we had a marvelous seller. He came to me and said, 'I must have a really great single. What have you got?' I said, 'Well, I've got three tracks, and two of them are the best tracks they've ever made.' We could put the two together and make a smashing single. We did, and it was a smashing single, but it was also a dreadful mistake. We would have sold far more and gotten higher up in the charts if I had issued one of those with, say, When I'm 64 on the back." What he's referring to is the fact that because the two songs were getting split as far as A-side and B-side, the
You mean as far as counting?
As far as counting, right, exactly. The number of sales and the amount of airplay. You know, if one side got airplay, only that side would get credit. If the other side got airplay, only that side would get credit. So they were actually in competition with themselves at that point in time. That's not enough to explain it because the songs really are so unbelievably inventive and fantastic that it's really hard to imagine that it was held back by a song by Engelbert Humperdinck. But nevertheless, you know, the truth
remains.
Yeah,
it's pretty stunning. Pretty stunning. The facts are there.
Right. So what I want to do now, while we can imagine this single being, you know, readied for release, about to hit the charts, the Beatles now continue along the very same lines with the other recordings that they've got going. They've unfortunately lost their two centerpieces, which they intended to be for the album, now that it's going out to be a single. But they weren't too worried about that because they were having a lot of, they're having fun in the studio. They were actually kind of loving it. And with the amount of experimentation that they were allowed to do now, there was no reason for them to not have any sense of concern about it. So we're going to pick up now. We're going to read from the Beatles Chronicle, which gives a day-by-day account of what was happening, starting with January 18th, which was a Wednesday in 1967. Actually, at this point in time, it's rather interesting because Paul is I think I mentioned last week that Paul had made this really strange recording, very much like Revolution 9, that he had handled over to a bunch of people who had created this Carnival of Light rave. A rave, imagine that, in 1967. But it's a fact that it happened and that Paul McCartney made music for it. And January 18th, here's the excerpt. "In a rare interview for the period, Paul went this afternoon to a small ground floor studio in one of the central London offices of the North of England-based Granada Television to discuss for inclusion in a special documentary the underground or counterculture movement presently thriving in the capital and in which he was a key participant." Paul is interviewed by Joe Durden-Smith, who conceived and produced this excellent 29-minute film for Granada's late-night scene special slot. The subtitle of the film was "It's So Far Out, It's Straight Down." And the director was John Shepherd, who in 1987 was to embrace the same topic again, using Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band as the centerpiece for a two-hour documentary, which was then titled It Was 20 Years Ago Today. "It's So Far Out, It's Straight Down" was screened by Granada in the North only on March 7th, and one can only wonder how the Northern viewers reacted to this sympathetic portrait of what was, even to most Londoners, a vexatious social curiosity. Paul appeared right at the beginning, and then here and there throughout the film, smartly dressed, mustachioed, and seated with legs crossed, politely doing his best to explain the movement's aims. Some of his quotes: "The Straits should welcome the underground because it stands for freedom. It's not strange. It's just new. It's not weird. It's just what's going on around." Durden-Smith also filmed the editorial board of International Times, the interior of the Indica bookshop, Pink Floyd playing Interstellar Overdrive at the UFO Club, a performance at the Roundhouse, and a happening at Piccadilly Circus. And the documentary also included footage of a poetry gathering at the Royal Albert Hall with Allen Ginsberg, Adrian Mitchell, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. In a sense, Paul's interview was used to add weight, credibility, and an approvable dimension to balance the occasionally unusual visual scenes. Well, essentially what that says right there on January 18th, 1967.
Yeah.
Welcome to the summer of love. Welcome to 1967. It's a brand new world. Everything is different.
Interesting.
The only way you're going to see the Beatles now is at these moments, and the Beatles themselves were changing behind the scenes on a weekly basis, if not a daily basis, with growing facial hair and changing their style, changing their attitudes about their music, their attitudes about confronting their music. The very next day after that, the Beatles go back into the recording studio on Thursday, January 19th. Again, excerpted straight from the Chronicle. The start of A Day in the Life, the song which was to become the stunning finale of the Beatles' next album. The first four takes were recorded in this 7:30 to 2:30 a.m. session. At this stage, the Beatles only knew that something later would be taped for the song's middle section. They had no idea what they were going to do in the middle yet at all, if you can imagine that.
Hopefully they weren't stressing it out.
Right. Well, that's just it. They weren't. It's so amazing. They say, well, we'll put something in there.
Right.
Just you know. Precisely
next.
What was going to go in there was totally uncertain. But to mark out the place where the item would go, they asked Mel Evans, their personal assistant, to count out the bars, 1 to 24, with his voice plastered with tape echo and backed by a tinkling piano. And to flag the end of this section, an alarm clock was set off.
Interesting.
Amazing, incredible. So just like on Revolver then, work on the new upcoming album began with the song that would turn out to be the song that closes the album and also the song that would be the most progressive song on the record. Just like the previous one. The following day, January 20th, reduction mixdowns of A Day in the Life happened, vacating tracks for more overdubbing. This took about 5 hours. Take six was marked best, and so was adorned with another John Lennon lead vocal, Paul's bass, and Ringo's drums. Paul's vocal also appeared for the first time. Here was a prime example of how the Lennon-McCartney songwriting partnership had evolved. John's song had a beginning and an end, but no middle. Paul had a middle, but no beginning or end. So the two pieces came naturally together, creating a complete picture and the impression that they were intended to be one song. The illusion was compounded by the fact that Paul's vocal, for the first line of which was, "Woke up, fell out of bed," occurred immediately after the alarm clock had been sounded on the original recording to mark the end of the first 24-count gap. Making good use of the happy coincidence, the alarm clock was kept on the track permanently. This is also a rather interesting excerpt that was taken from the Daily Mail, an English newspaper that John had stumbled upon around this time. The title of the article is "The Holes in Our Roads." The first sentences are, "There are 4,000 holes in the road in Blackburn, Lancashire, or 1/26th of a hole per person, according to a council survey." If Blackburn is typical, there are 2 million holes in Britain's roads and 300,000 in London.
Whoa.
Whew. All right, then. With all that being said, the anthology collection put out by the Beatles actually took the first few sessions, takes one and two of the Beatles working on this track, and then cut into it, spliced into it, take six, where we have Paul overdubbing his vocal, as we had just read that what happened on these two consecutive days.
Right.
Here is that composite recording. I must ask you, if I may, that the track number that we need to cue up is not track number one, but we need to cue up track number five. Here, then, is that composite recording of A Day in the Life.
Have the mic on the piano quite low. Just keeping it like maracas, you know. You know those old pianos. Okay, we're on.
Sugar Bum Fairy. Sugar Bum Fairy. Thank you.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was from the House of Lords. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away. But I just had to look, having read.
Whew, oh man, something else. For full disclosure, that orchestral bit was actually from a later take. I think they just put it in there for reference. That was a composite version, actually, that was made exclusively for the anthology. Rather than just playing one specific take, they took a couple of different takes and spliced them together so you could get a real good flavor of how the song began to progress in the studio. So that's what you had been hearing there. That's why you'll suddenly hear the orchestra coming up
right
in the second half when it didn't exist earlier in the beginning.
Hmm.
It's also interesting to note, by the way, that on take six, when Paul was overdubbing those guide vocal bits, and it was just a guide vocal to show people where they would be in the song, because obviously right. It's not the one that made the track. That's also Paul on piano playing those parts. And it sounds like it's the part that ended up staying on the final track, because I could not discern any real difference between the piano parts on that take and the one that was actually released. So anyway, work does continue, more or less chronologically, day in, day out, with some breaks. And we can move forward, actually, from January to early February. Actually, on February 8th, Wednesday, February 8th, the Beatles are back in the studio, and they start putting down rhythm tracks of another new song by John. John had, was inspired to write a song after watching a Kellogg's Corn Flakes commercial on television.
Interestingly enough.
He sees a commercial, and he's like, that gives me
an idea.
So he starts writing a song based upon the Kellogg's Corn Flakes commercial. Then, of course, later on, after the basic track is done, they decide to add a few more overdubs. I can play the actual basic track, but here's some interesting information about the overdubs on the track. The overdubbing of Brass onto take 10 of Good Morning, Good Morning took place on March 16th, and it took place by six members of the group Sounds Incorporated, who you may know. They did a really good version of a track called Cast Your Fate to the Wind, a really beautiful instrumental that came out in 66. There were three saxophone players from the group, two trombones, and a French horn, Tom someone, nobody can recall his name. Previously, Sounds Incorporated, now they were called Sounds Inc. They were a top instrumental group who had a long history of backing American stars in Europe. They had first met the Beatles at the Star Club way back in April 1962. They were signed to a NIMS management contract by Brian Epstein in March 1964 and had then played on some of the Beatles' tours, including the August 65 U.S. visit that resulted in the TV film The Beatles at Shea Stadium. So they were on that show and in that film. They got paid for some reason a total amount of £201 for their work for the overdubs on this session. Here then is that song in progress, early takes of the track Good Morning, Good Morning. We'll be right back. Wow, that is wild to hear that. What the heck is Ringo doing at the end of that track?
He's having fun.
It sounds so crazy, wacky. I mean, just hearing that song without the overdubs there. No lead guitar, of course.
Yeah, it's cool.
The horn overdubs.
It shows you work in progress.
Yeah, it's really just to hear that rhythm section, just because, you know what, that's the type of thing. If you wanted to learn the song, there it is, you know, without all that extra stuff layered on top of it. You could learn the song perfectly by just listening to those bass parts right there. Brilliant. Because it's got some cool time changes and all sorts of crazy things that are going on there. All right, then. The next day, this is an amazing fact to think that at this point in time, this is still true. However, up until this day, the Beatles never, ever recorded, made a single studio recording anywhere other than at Abbey Road. From the very first album until this point in time, every single thing that the Beatles had done was recorded at Abbey Road. And here's an excerpt then from, again, from the Chronicle for this date, February 9th, 1967, was a Thursday. The Beatles' first EMI session at a British studio other than Abbey Road. I'm glad it says EMI because, you know what, you could have called me out and said, well, wait a minute, what about before they had a contract? We're not counting that. I'm not counting the Decca sessions. Regent Sound was one of the few independently owned facilities in London at this time. No longer a member of EMI staff, if you remember, he went independent.
Right.
George Martin was now free to travel with the Beatles. But balance engineer Jeff Emmerich and the usual crew at Abbey Road tape ops were all EMI employees, so they could not go along. Adrian Ibbotson, chief engineer at Regent Sound, filled Emmerich's role for this session in which three takes of a new song by Paul called Fixing a Hole were recorded. So that song was actually begun somewhere other than Abbey Road. Unfortunately, this book does not tell me why they did that.
Hmm.
And I can't answer that question. I wish that I could. I do not.
Maybe just availability.
Right. Or maybe, yeah, I might have just been, you know, we can do anything we want to. Why don't we try someplace different and see what happens? I would imagine that they would have had, even though they brought along George Martin, they would have had to have missed Jeff Emmerich, who was now doing so many, helping them with so many of their creative ideas. He was like the enabler for some of the wacky things that they were coming up
right.
with.
Right. Their little concepts.
Exactly. So on February 10th, it was a short experiment. They're back at Abbey Road the very next day, so I'll read right from the Chronicle once again what's happening here now. There can be no doubt that 1967 was a heady year for the Beatles, and February 10th must rank as one of the highlights. It was Paul who had decided upon the best way of filling that 24-bar gap in a day in the life, an orchestral build-up with perhaps 90 musicians playing from a pre-selected low note to the highest their respective instrument could play. As usual, the task of making this vision of reality fell to George Martin, who was paid £18 for his arrangement, in which the instruction to each musician was A, start very quietly and end very loud, B, start very low in pitch and end up very high, and C, make your own way up the scales, independent of your neighbor. Although only 40 musicians were used instead of 90, the cost still came to £367, a bit more, which is quite an investment for the time. Paul got more than he had even requested in the long run, though, because the orchestra was recorded four times onto all of the tracks of a four-track tape. It was later mixed down to one, so in essence, there was the equivalent of 160 musicians that ended up playing that passage on A Day in the Life. But the technical aspects of the recording tell only half of the story. The 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. session was, more than anything else, an event. The Beatles asked the musicians to wear a full evening dress, but then, additionally, don novelties. Violinist David McCallum wore a red clown's nose. Lead violinist Eric Groenberg, a gorilla's paw on his bow hand.
Oh, that's funny.
Everyone wore funny hats or some other sort of carnival novelty. The two bassoons had balloons tied to their ends, which inflated and deflated as the instruments were played.
That's too much.
When the orchestra had gone home and the Beatles and some friends stayed behind and attempted to record the song's coda, later a crashing piano chord, which at this stage was going to be a long hum. Right. Three such takes dissolved into laughter, but the next was good enough for the ensemble to add overdubs, filling the four-track tape. This was to remain the best idea of ending A Day in the Life until the famous piano chord was taped on February 22nd. The orchestral element of the session was filmed by NEMS Enterprises, with Tony Brownwell producing, exercising as much control as he could over the 7 handheld cameras utilized for shooting this most chaotic of events. The film was later edited, along with some stock, that is non-Beatles footage, into a finished clip for A Day in the Life, but it was never screened at the time, neither in Britain, where the song was eventually banned by the BBC, which we'll get to later on, nor elsewhere, amazingly, which is a pity because the footage captured the essence of the evening, making for a compelling, if chaotic, little film, with all the musicians in evening dress, many wearing silly novelties like upside-down spectacles, plastic stick-on nipples, red noses, false eyes, fake cigars, and, on heads, imitation bald pates and knotted handkerchiefs. It also showed George's wife, Patty, and the many friends especially invited along by the Beatles, among them Mick Jagger, Marianne Faithfull, Keith Richard, Mike Nesmith, Donovan, and Simon and Marique of designer group The Fool. Marique actually played a tambourine during the orchestral overdub, which remained in the final mixes. It showed girl fans being ejected by Neil Aspinall and bubbles floating around the expanse of EMI Studio One. If you see the film version of the anthology collection that was put together a number of years back, they did excerpts from the film that was taken that day into the anthology series.
We'll have to watch it again.
Yeah, we should definitely. In fact, that we should pick up on that because that's always fun. February 13th, cutting forward one more day. It was a Monday. This 7 p.m. until 4 in the morning session began with the preparation of 4 new mixes of A Day in the Life and then turned to a new recording of a new number that George had written, which eventually would turn into Only a Northern Song. It actually would eventually be cut from the album, put into an archive, and then pulled out again for the Yellow Submarine soundtrack. But at this point, it was intended to be on Sgt. Pepper's. In keeping with George's frequent shortage of song titles, the title for this song, as they were working on it, was called simply Not Known. A wry comment on the fact that it would be published by Northern Songs. Only a Northern Song was going to be George's chief contribution to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. As it transpired, though, the song didn't see commercial release until January 1969, as I said, on the Yellow Submarine soundtrack album. Here, though, is excerpts of them working on the song from that February 13 session.
Myself.
another fascinating inside look, almost like getting a peek behind the scenes of the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz when you hear these tracks without all the overdubs, you know? It's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
That time, of course, George's song, Only a Northern Song. Well, you can actually really get the humor of his lyrics, hearing them, like, when the song is stripped down. A lot of the overdubs sort of, I think, sublimated the humor of the words. And you can see that George was probably having quite a great deal of fun with writing that song.
Yeah, I'd say so.
And with Only a Northern Song, of course, being a direct reference to the company that was handling all of their publishing. Because every Beatles song was published by Northern Songs, or NEMS, you know, NEMS Enterprises. So there you have it. Now, I'm going to go back just a little bit, because it was around this time in history that the single Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane was just about to be released to an unsuspecting public. And the Beatles, just before the release, had worked on a couple of films. So I'm going to read, again, excerpts from the Chronicle. This actually goes back to January 30th now of 1967. Peter Goldman, a director of the TV pop shows in his native Sweden, was responsible for the films. He was recommended to the Beatles by a mutual good friend, of course, Klaus Voormann, the German who had first met the Beatles in Hamburg in 1960,
mm-hmm.
became a musician of him on his own right and was signed by Brian Epstein, became an artist, the guy who designed the Beatles' revolver sleeve, and who at this point in time was actually the bass player with Manfred Mann. At the Beatles' request, Goldman arrived in England during the early part of January and spent time surveying suitable shoot locations in and around London, as well as watching the group record at Abbey Road. He chose two locations and Knoll Park near Sevenoaks, Kent, about 20 miles southeast of London, which was the first site to be used. This enormous area where deer roam freely is owned and maintained by the National Trust and contains a 15th century house and golf course. The Beatles came to Knoll Park on three occasions, the first two to shoot sequences for Strawberry Fields Forever, and the third to film for Penny Lane. Typically, the films broke new ground, for having already helped to pioneer rock-era promo films in the first place with their self-produced, relatively straightforward performance clips, the Beatles now forged ahead with storyboard films in which there was no performance element at all, just a succession of sequences which directly or indirectly explored the meaning and feeling of the music. The first shoot in Knoll Park took place in the evening darkness, the group filming a number of sequences for Strawberry Fields Forever around a large dead oak tree behind the birdhouse. While they were filming, George Martin was toiling away at EMI Studios producing a rough mono cut of A Day in the Life so that acetate discs could be cut. A few days later, on February 5th, it was a Sunday, I'll read again from the Chronicle, with the shooting of the Strawberry Fields Forever clip now complete, the Beatles and film director Peter Goldman turned their attentions to Penny Lane. Keen to capture the flavor of the Liverpool suburban lane, yet unwilling or unable, excuse my phone, yet unwilling or unable to travel to the actual area itself, the Beatles went to Stratford in the East End of London, where they were filmed riding white horses and walking in and around Angel Lane. To further the illusion that the Beatles were actually walking in Penny Lane, Goldman and his crew from Don Long Productions went there without the group and shot footage of some of the local landmarks mentioned in the song, the barber shop and the bus shelter in the middle of the roundabout, as well as the famous green Liverpool buses. This footage was then intercut with the Beatles' sequences. Then, of course, comes that day, February 17th. It's a Friday. The day that the single Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane was released in Britain saw the Beatles engaged at the same time in an 8-hour session from 7 p.m. until 3 in the morning at EMI Studios, beginning the recording of Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite.
Oh.
John's lyric for this song derived almost entirely from a poster advertising a circus near Rochdale, Lancashire, in February 1843, which he had bought in a Sevenoaks antique shop on January 31 while there for the shooting of the Strawberry Fields Forever promotional film. So here he is basically, you know, sitting, waiting around to do takes for that movie, found the poster, brought the poster home, wrote another song. The single's released and he writes a new song. Wonderful, you know, fantastic.
How fortuitous.
Really. The first seven takes were rhythm track recordings only, with George Martin playing the harmonium. John then overdubbed the vocal onto the last of these. The four-track tape was then reduced into takes 8 and 9, and John recorded another vocal onto the latter. A rough mono mix was made at the end of the session. We actually have that very first take from that very first day. Here it is, the rough version of Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. Nope, we already played it.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, this is take one. Being for the benefit.
You can just hear how raw the idea is at this point in time.
Yeah, he has no idea where he's going with that.
I mean, he's literally like reading the words off of the poster at this point. I don't even know if he's transposed them yet. You know, like, is it for the benefit of Mr. Kite or being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, as the poster read? You know, the title ended up being one thing, but John was basically playing with the words to try to fit them into the melody that was in his head. Well, a couple of days later, he returned to the studios to continue work on the song, again, from the Chronicles. When the Beatles started work on Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, John had told George Martin, in effect, that he wanted the recording bathed in a circus atmosphere. Unable to trace an authentic hand-operated steam organ for the part, George realized that the required sound would have to be self-created inside Abbey Road using other means. So, he got a hold of some old Calliope tapes of Sousa marches and had Jeff Emmerich chop them up into small sections, throw them in the air, and then reassemble the pieces at random.
Well, that was clever.
Amazing, right? Which is what ended up giving you the crazy sound effects on the track. Here, then, is a later take, a bit of a composite, of the exact same song, Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite.
Topping the bill.
So wild. Just the unabashed creativity that is going on at this point in time. This is 1967 when they're doing this. I mean, of course, you could now say, everybody was doing crazy things in 67. Well, no. People started doing crazy things in 67 after this came out because this changed the face of music. This changed people's very idea of what popular music was. Really. And, you know, the Beatles were just, frankly, they were just having fun. And they had a producer that was having just as much fun as they were.
Thank goodness.
George Martin was so much the fifth Beatle. I mean, if you think about the things that you love about these songs, and the person who'd be able to, like I said, who could actually enact what they were trying to do and come up with these, with the ability to do these things. Hey, I have an idea. I've got these old Calliope things. Let's just cut them up and that'll give, yeah, it's genius. They definitely would not have been the same band without George Martin.
Absolutely.
And with appropriate praise given to Jeff Emerick as well around this time. Okay, then, picking up where the story left off, other tracks that the Beatles are working on February 28th. We'll again read directly from the Chronicle. It was by 1967 customary procedure for the Beatles to spend unlimited time rehearsing in the studio before recording takes, as I had said earlier at the start of the show. This may seem extravagant today, with studio costs being so high, but with EMI recording the Beatles at its own facility, studio time was merely an internal cost, and certainly not one deducted from the group's royalties.
Thank goodness for them.
Really. And besides, it was the Beatles at this point, their number one cash cow. Rehearsals during this, again, another 8-hour session from 7 p.m. until 3 in the morning, of John's new song entitled Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. It took so long that no proper recordings were made at all. These began the next night instead. They only had little snippets. The song's title had come about when John's 3-year-old son Julian returned home from nursery school with a painting of a girl in his group. John asked him what it was called, and Julian replied, "It's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds." So it was mere coincidence, then, that the song's initial letters spelt LSD, although there can be little doubt that it was this very substance which caused, for the song's lyrics, such colorful word imagery to spill from John's head onto paper. And I'm sure that John was very much aware of that coincidence at the time. The very next day, March 1st, 1967, 7 takes of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds were recorded in this session that lasted from 7 until 2:15 in the morning, and then the 7th was reduced into take 8, ready for overdubbing. Finally, on March 2nd, the following day, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was one of the quickest of Sgt. Pepper recordings. One night for the rhythm track, another for overdubs. This session, again, almost 8 hours, took care of the latter with a succession of vari-speeded vocal and instrumental recordings being added to take 8. Here, then, off of the Beatles anthology, is a composite recording of those various takes, with allowing us some insight into the recording process, much as we heard earlier on A Day in the Life.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly, a girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Flowers that grow so incredibly high. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore, waiting to take you away. Climb in the back with your head in. station with plasticine porters with looking glass ties. Suddenly someone is there at the turnstile, the girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
What would eventually become a definitive, defining track of John Lennon's career, one of the defining song of the psychedelic era, perhaps.
Yes.
Certainly the most psychedelic, you know, well, the most blatantly psychedelic song off of Sgt. Pepper's. I wish, of course, that I had more time than this 1 hour. There's a few different things I'd like to get to in this show before we get to Sgt. Pepper proper, which I hope to do to some extent at least next week. Oh, there's so much information to be covered. It might be one of those shows where we just talk about all the things going on before we get to the actual album. But we will continue with a look at the preparation for Sgt. Pepper next week for certain. And I'll discuss one more song now before that happens. We had played only a Northern song earlier, which was the song that George had come in with. But on March 15th, actually, he came down with yet another track, something else that he had come up with. It was actually something which had a title. It was called Within You, Without You. Typically, well, actually, I shouldn't say that it did not have a title at this point, excuse me. Typically untitled at this earliest stage, it was the most Indian-sounding song ever to appear on a Beatles album, although George was to write and record others later for his Wonderwall film soundtrack, which he'd do later in the year in 1967 and also in early 1968. The basic track of Within You, Without You, Take One, was taped during one session on March 15th. Contributing tabla was Not Fair Sony from the North London-based Eastern, not Asian music circle. Amrat Gajar played Dilruba. P.D. Joshi played the sword mandal, while one other man, his name not documented by BMI, played a droning tambura along with George and also Neil Aspinall. At no time did any of the other Beatles participate in the recording of this song. A rough mono mix of the night's work was made between 1:30 and 2 a.m. and taken home to Escher by George. It's interesting to note that the song was eventually finished on April 4th. Imagine that the one thing that was left to be done, though, again, George Martin's genius. He was going to overdub Western orchestral instruments on top of the Indian arrangement, which now you have this fantastic composite of East meets West. You hear orchestral instruments that everybody in Europe would be familiar with on top of these rather exotic instruments that George is bringing into the studio. So rather than just hearing a purely Indian track, it becomes a phenomenal composite. And on April 14th, final mono and stereo mixing and editing of Within You and Without You took place. At George Harrison's request, a few seconds of laughter were added to the end of the mix, courtesy of the Abbey Road Effects tape, Volume 6, Applause and Laughter. So that's not the Beatles in the studio cracking up after the take. That was literally something taken from a sound effects tape. On the Beatles anthology recording, they were able to grab the original master recording that existed before George put on his vocals and create a brand new master from that four-track original. So it's pretty cool because it's a composite, a purely instrumental composite from the original four-track master before there were any vocals. So we will end our show with that track. And as I said, we will return with more information regarding the preparation of Sgt. Pepper next week. Take care, everybody. Have a great, comfortable, hopefully not too hot and dry weekend.
You're